Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. We've got lots in store for you on today's show. We'll be previewing the final test of the India-England series. We'll be looking at how the England women's side are doing in New Zealand. We've got a pre-recorded interview with Tammy Beaumont, who is now the highest ranked women's ODI batter on the planet. And we'll be having a quick look at what's going on elsewhere in the PSL, the Australia-New Zealand series, and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, and the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon. Starting on the test match, we've not had a huge amount of England team news ahead of the fourth test, other than that Chris Wokes has gone home as part of the rest and rotation policy. Ben Folkes has said that England, having trained at the ground, are expecting a similar surface to the one we had in the third test match. Joe, if it is played on something similar to what we've seen in the last two tests, do England have a chance?
I would love to say yes. I don't really feel like they do at this point, but then perhaps I'm still suffering the aftershocks of the last match. It's worth remembering that at the start of this series, if England had been offered 2-1 down with one to play, they'd have absolutely snapped your hand off. And actually, we'd have probably said at the start of the series that even a 3-1 defeat wouldn't have been too bad from England's perspective, given India's record at home. But it's hard to see, given that India will prepare a very similar pitch, given that England's batsmen struggled quite as bad as they did in the last test and the test before that, to see them come back from here would be... we talked about the first test win being England's greatest away win, possibly. I think if they had to win this test, then this would have to trump that. And also India have everything to play for as well, the World Test Championship final on the line. I don't see them letting up. So it's a real, real hard task for England here. I think India are massive, massive favourites.
Yeah, I'd agree with basically all of that. But I do think that the point that has been made, I think, on this podcast by others before, that sort of pitch does just make the game a bit more of a lottery and a bit more of a shootout. That does still hold, even though that England have found themselves on the wrong end of a couple in a row. Like, I think that Joe Root, Johnny Bairstow is a very good player of spin. Ben Folkes, as we know, Zach Crawley, who batted brilliant in the last test, they're all capable of hitting that kind of match-changing 70, which in a sort of 150 plays, 180 sort of game can be absolutely crucial. They just haven't done it so far. Like in the first test, you had England being 77 for two, and actually that could have turned into 200, which would have been a match-defining total in that game, but that didn't happen. But I think that they should still have hope, even in, but like, that sort of surface could be a positive in a way, even though it hasn't been so far, I think. I mean, maybe that's being very, very optimistic, and I do agree that India are very heavy favourites, but I can just about see how England could snatch one on this sort of surface, I guess.
Well, I suppose if you're looking for reasons to be positive, the fact that England did manage to get to, what, 70 for two in that last test match, if they had managed to get to, say, 220, 250, then they were absolutely right in the game, probably leading the game. So that wasn't beyond them in that first test, but it just feels, we said right at the start of this whole winter before England went to Sri Lanka, that Joe Root was going to have a massive winter for England to get any success. And it feels like, what, five tests in, it feels even more like that he's really one of very few England batsmen who are capable of playing a match-turning innings in these kind of conditions.
Hard to argue with much of that, really. I think Ben's point that there is a crapshoot element to this game is probably worth re-emphasising. I have a weird feeling that the pitch, in a kind of alpha-like statement from India, will not be quite as wild as the one was last week. I just have a feeling. I might be wrong. England will be saying to themselves, Rohit Sharma's been the difference between the two teams with the bat so far. No one else has really got many. Kohli got a beautiful 70 in the first test match, but hasn't got many since. Shubman Gill's the same. Rahane's not really been at the races. Pant has, you know, suggested here and there, but not really evoked any kind of permanence. So there will be reasons to be cautiously chipper about being able to bowl India out twice and bowl India out relatively cheaply twice if the pitch does turn. The question is obviously, where are they going to find runs? They've now batted across five innings and not even got close to 200 in five innings straight. I think 160 something is their highest effort across five innings. So obviously that is pretty damning. That goes without saying. If you take out Root's brilliance across the whole winter, then I think England's have managed 550s across 5 test matches across the whole of their batting lineup. So no one's in form as such, but there is a randomness to this series. I think as Ben says, somebody has to play out their skin. But if somebody plays the innings of their life, and, you know, Stokes played really well, for example, in the second innings in the last test match, but before, yeah, as ever, getting one that was a bit too good for him. But he got to 25-30 and the tempo of that innings was excellent. Now, if he can double up on that, if Crawley could push on to 70, and if Root can play, you know, yet another defining innings of what's been an extraordinary win to him personally, then there are logical ways that you can say that they can scrap this one out. They have no more than a puncher's chance. They never really did at the start of the series. But this has been a very peculiar and memorable, for good and bad reasons, 3 test matches. I don't think this final test match just sort of ebbs away predictably. I think there will be one last blow up and it will probably fall to India, but it may yet fall to England.
What would be really nice is to have a proper match. And I don't mean that we haven't seen some great cricket in this series, because we have, but we haven't had a proper contest yet. We haven't had a game that's really felt live going deep into that match. And it would be great, particularly with what Channel 4 have done to get this series, if whichever way it goes, whoever you support, if we could actually get a proper game to finish off the series where both sides are in it, if we can stretch it to day 3, maybe even day 4. That would be great to watch. And I think even Indian fans might fancy that as well, because I think as much as they must love rolling England in 2 days, most fans, whoever you support, would like to see a proper match going deep into at least day 4.
No question. Let's not do the pitch thing. I don't think we're planning to anyway. But in all of the bluster and nonsense and hot air that's been spouted and spewed over the last week or two, That's the only real question to answer. What does it leave the game looking like for the people that it's there for, i.e. the fans across the board, not just the fans in one province or another, but the fans across the game? This is a marquee series. This is a huge landmark series. So let's try and honour it with a great game of cricket. It doesn't matter who wins. It really doesn't. But the game doesn't win if it's done in 5 and a bit sessions. And only the most one-eyed, parochial, myopic fanboys can wake up after 2 days of cricket and be happy that it's all done and dusted. We just want something to honour the beauty of this game, to see this peculiar, eccentric series off.
If you just look through the numbers of the two teams' batsmen this series, there's barely any of them who've got runs. Sharma and Root apart, really, they all average under 32, 33. And that's what I think has really been lacking this series, like really good batsmanship, like a day where you're like, oh, that was a really good inning. Since the first test, that's only really happened off Rohit Sharma's bat. So I think that's just been a very obvious thing that we've been missing from the series.
Just want to add, I really hope that come the return leg, and it's probably worth remembering that this is kind of building up to half time in this peculiar 9 test match epic between these two teams. I really do hope that come the summer, we do see Kohli, Sharma batting all afternoon at Lord's, strumming it around on a relatively flat one, posting a total that England can then respond to, and that we have some real proper strong epic test matches this summer coming up. We got echoes of that when they were here last time round. Obviously Kohli's innings at Edgbaston is one of the great innings ever played, but that still felt like it was a lone crusade by him. It would be really good to see some humdinger test matches that go 4.5 and even 5 days, even a draw. Do you remember them? Even a draw at some point this summer. I would welcome that. I think it would be an important statement to make, and it would be good for the game in the long term.
We've talked a fair bit this series about how difficult it is to read a pitch, and a lot's been made of how England didn't get that right in the third test. And I don't think India did either, actually. They bowled pace for quite a lot. You know, we're talking about England's good start in the first innings. I think a big reason for that is because India bowled a lot of pace. So if this is a big if, this is more hypothetical, but Jim Amos asks, if the pitch is like it was for the third test, should England consider picking just 2 spinners, 8 batsmen and a wicketkeeper?
Do you know what? My mate Ronnie, who's actually a very astute observer of the game, WhatsApped us after that game and said essentially that two spinners, Archer, eight batsmen, eight, nine batsmen, and let's just see where we get to. And his tongue was only partially in his cheek. In the end, England won't get that funky, obviously. But there is an argument to load the batting up a little bit more. I mean, you know, Ben Foulkes is a stoic kind of old-fashioned accumulator who plays spin nicely, but him at seven and then a chasm thereafter is a problem. Is a problem for the side. It's all very well saying, well, the top order's got to get the runs, but as we've seen in test matches of late, it's often that down the pipe that solves the problem. We saw Ashwin get that 100 in the second test match. We've seen Pant come out and do similar things as well. There is some degree of logic to it.
So what we say, Rory Burns, you're back in, but you're batting at nine.
Yeah. Best will definitely come back in. You know, they've held their hands up on that one, and so he will come back in. And you imagine that him and Leach, with Root, and I know that Root's back is dicky, but he's also a pretty useful third spinner. They will get through 80% of the work, no doubt about it, irrespective of what the pitch does initially. That will be the way that the game will have to play out.
Yeah, I'm not expecting England to do this in the deciding test of a high profile series, but I would genuinely love to see a county do it at Taunton or something like that. A few years ago, Worcestershire got really funky in a game. I think it was a green top, 150 paid 150. Then Joe Leach just came out on number five as a pinch hitter, basically in search of quick runs. We need to see more of that. Ben, you had your hand up.
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, if you could guarantee the pitch is going to play like that, it's quite a big if. It's probably the main thing. I think that, as you know, no one actually quite knew how that third test pitch was going to play until, you know, halfway through the first session, the first day even. But I think what England could, or in my opinion, should consider, I don't think they will, but it's just playing a third proper spinner, probably Matt Parkinson, in my opinion. I think that would be kind of the ideal scenario. If he's the third spinner in a three-man attack and you've got, you know, another quick and you've got a proper rounder in Stokes and you've got a very good part-timer in Joe Root, that kind of takes the pressure off and means that you can use him as he's kind of supposed to be used, as like a, you know, a proper partnership breaker, kind of say, you know, just give it a rip and see what happens. And if not, no huge harm done because we've got loads of other bowlers who can bowl for a long time. I'd really like to see that. And I think that could potentially be the ideal way for him to make a start. But I don't think they will, but I'd like to see it.
But how could they play three spinners in that setup? How would that work?
Three spinners, one quick, and then Stokes and Root as your sort of fill-ins as well.
So go back to Sri Lanka 2018-19 time and just throw the ball to Jimmy initially and hope that he might winkle one or two out and then just hope for the best with the spinners.
Essentially, yeah.
Well, it's telling that we've not bothered, perhaps it's just fatigue, but we've not bothered to debate even who the seamers should be. And the newspapers don't seem to be doing so either, maybe because it's just become a bit of a lottery by this stage, but also because it feels like it doesn't matter all that much.
Sorry, I wonder if having had their time again, well, for those last three tests, especially the last two, whether they'd have gone for Wokes, who's obviously now gone home, just because he is sort of a more genuine batting option. That was, you know, and in a way, that's actually quite a big factor in that last game, was the fact that, like, you know, it was partly the lack of security for the top eight, that, you know, it was Archer at number eight, which meant they had kind of no chance. Like, once they were 90 for five, they were going to be, or 90 for six, they were going to be all out pretty soon after. Whereas if you have someone who you know you can bat with, then that just changes the kind of complexion of the batting innings at that point. And you feel like, okay, maybe we can sort of scrap away up to 150 rather than it's going to be all over pretty soon.
Joe, what is your prediction for what it's worth for the bowling attack?
Well, so Best comes back in. I would go back to the bowling attack that played the first test match. So Archer, Anderson, Best, Leach with Stokes. Although I do have to say, I think what Ben says has a lot of logic to it. I could easily see playing Parkinson over Archer would have some value. It just feels so unlikely that it's difficult to kind of even consider it. But I do think there's some logic behind it.
Yeah, I would echo that as well, though. I think the way that Archer bowled in that first test match, albeit on that particular track, I think that should sway it, and that would be my pick as well. It was interesting, though, to see Stokes really struggle with the ball in that last test match. So you are going in there effectively with a four-man attack as things stand. I mean, admittedly, he can always turn it on through willpower as much as anything else. But he's not bowling very much at all at the moment. Yeah, any number of reasons, I guess, for that, not least the conditions. So it's going to be two spinners taking a lot of the work, in which case I would be strongly leaning towards playing Archer first and Anderson alongside him personally, because he still possesses that potential. He still possesses that moment where he can blow somebody away.
Yeah, I don't really have a strong opinion on the seam attack. We did a thing on wisdom.com where we predicted our 11s or wrote down the 11s we wanted to see, and I marginally went for Stone ahead of Archer. He bowled really well in the second test match, but completely see what you're saying. I wonder if I'm reading too much into this, but England haven't actually named a squad for the fourth test, and they did do for the third test. And I wonder if that means they're more likely to use one of the reserve guys. They haven't restricted themselves to a group of just 15 or 16. Maybe I am just reading too much into that. But anyway, we talked a lot last week about how England can better prepare themselves for test matches in spinning conditions. And we've got a question on this, or more of a suggestion, really. So interested to see what your thoughts are. So a friend of the show, Scott Oliver, says, "This is an idea to improve England's production of spinners and their batters so they can play spin better. Pick a venue outside county's traditional home grounds. Armada buys it. All counties play two home and two away matches there each year, as well as more at outgrounds. What do you think, Ben?"
Yeah, well, I think it's time for English cricket to get funky in one way or another, whether it's Phil wrote a very good piece on wisdom.com this week, which had a couple of funky suggestions at the end. One, not quite as out there as that, but one was sort of having a spin substitute option so that teams could bring in a spinner and they could just be bowling on that last day, essentially. That was quite good. Or possibly just a way to play more counter cricket in the middle of the summer would be to have the championship alongside the 100, which would be controversial, but would also, I mean, because you'd have, you know, some of England's prospective test players will be playing in the 100. You know, you've got your likes of Joe Clark, Matt Parkinson will be there. But, you know, the next Jack Leach was not going to get a 100 contract, Dom Sibley, for example. So you would get players being able to test themselves kind of away from that in the height of summer. So I think that both those options have something. What I'd suggest, I mean, if you were going to do that, I guess the way to do it would be to probably do it outside of England altogether, maybe start the season or end the season with a sort of a, probably start the season, you don't want to end the season like that, with like a sort of mini festival in Abu Dhabi, maybe, where you're allowed to sort of properly get into the pitches and have like a, you know, all teams play one game against another in the course of a week across sort of like how many grounds they have out there. There's about 5 grounds they have out there, Yaz, which could all be used, I guess. Maybe that's something, but it would be very difficult logistically, obviously controversial, but I think that that's the kind of thinking we should be seeing, because otherwise England are just never going to get better at playing and bowling spin, and it's only going to get worse as, you know, more stuff comes in to cram the county championship into, you know, May and April and September.
I think something outlandish like Scott's idea, or kind of what Ben's suggesting, is kind of not that far wide of the mark, really, because I'm a bit sceptical of this idea that we just play more championship games in the middle of summer, spinners get to bowl a bit more, and suddenly English batsmen are great at playing high quality spin. Like, that is all, I agree that all those things should happen, but I'm still not convinced if that was in place, the last couple of weeks would have been any different, just because the conditions are just so wildly different to what we would see in county cricket, even if spinners were encouraged. I mean, there would obviously be, you'd expect some improvement, but I don't think, it's just comparing apples and pears, really. So I think it does require some sort of extreme adaptations of the kind that Scott and Ben are talking about. And it'd be fun, and it would get people interested, and it would get people engaged. And that's, again, half the battle, really.
There was an interesting article in The Telegraph that went through a few suggestions, and one of them was based off something that's been happening in the West Indies first class competition recently. So a few years ago, a really, really high percentage of wickets to fall went to spin. And as a result, they brought in a rule that you got like decimal point level bonus points for certain number of wickets taken by seam. So you're incentivized to bowl more seamers. And that has led to a steady increase in the number of wickets taken by seam in the domestic competitions there over the last 5 years. That damages the integrity of the tournament a little bit. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I don't think we're that far off ending up with something reasonably odd that would have been written off completely a few years ago. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Well, it's probably related to what we're talking about, really. The ECB confirmed the full-time appointments for Chris Silverwood's support coaching staff. It was no great surprise to hear that Triskovic was confirmed as so-called elite batting coach. He's been involved with the team now on and off for a year or two. He's a cracker of a bloke, as everybody knows, and he knows batting inside out. He's a smart appointment, I would say. John Lewis, the former Gloucester seamer, has been confirmed as the pace bowling coach. And Jeetan Patel, who's been working with the spinners for a year or so now, has also been confirmed as elite spin bowling coach. But the thing that particularly interested me, mainly because I know him and like him and once hit him for six, Richard Dawson, coach at Gloucester, who is a deeply impressive bloke, one of the youngest coaches around the county game, who brought Gloucester up, of course, in 2019 on a small budget, and they've overachieved in one day cricket as well. He's a very, very cool, calm, relaxed, sort of mysterious bloke, I suppose, Richard Dawson. But anyway, he knows the game, and he has a real knack with young players in particular. And he spoke very evocatively when I went down to Bristol to interview him a year or two ago about the joy and pleasure that he gets from bringing players through. And he spoke as well in the round regarding what county cricket is for. And he was sitting in a stand alongside, paying members of Gloucestershire County Cricket Club, and yet recognised that there was a bigger play at work, that there was a bigger picture in which to contribute, and that picture is the England cricket team. So his appointment as, in effect, bringing through, he is head of pathway development, but he's taken on the role with England. He'll be overseeing the Young Lions programme, he'll be overseeing the Under-19s programme. He was the coach when England's Lions team did very well in Australia last winter, or maybe even the winter before. Now I lose track in COVID times. But the winter when Daniel Lawrence made a lot of runs and England beat Australia's reserves as well in a test match at the MCG. He oversaw that very successful tour, and now he's going to be overseeing bringing young players through. Now, one of the things that they said, which is particularly important, is that bringing spin bowlers through is a quote, real priority now for the coaching system. Richard Dawson's a former England off-spinner. Jeetan Patel is now a full-time spin coach with the England setup. Their job will be to identify young spinners and try their damnedest to get them more overs under their belt, as discussed, more significant overs in professional cricket. And to try and change the complexion of the game as much as possible. He's a very, very good appointment as this elite pathway coach, I would say.
So I'm trying to get a better understanding of what the pathway is and who the players Dawson will work with will be. So how old will these young spinners be? Are they players that we'll probably already have heard of, or players lower down the chain?
A bit of both, but there'll be... The idea is that it's as joined up as possible. And Mo Bobat, who oversees the whole coaching system of the ECB, is very big on that. So you're identifying spinners at 14, 15, 16, whose names you don't yet know, who are then taken into the centralised system in effect. And Dawson's particular remit will be to run the under-19s team as well as the Young Lions programme. So it will be his job to nurture talent from mid-teens and even possibly earlier than that, but to get it as joined up as possible. Now, one thing to add about spin bowling in particular, as everybody knows, is that the properties of being a good spinner change as you get older through those teenage years. Your body changes, your trajectory changes, the angle changes. A lot of players suffer with yips issues as they're coming through. That's a common concern. But the logic is good, I think. The system needs to back and support these young talents a bit more than it has done in the past. And the more joined up it is, the more coherent it is, the better. Someone like Dawson, who is very, very logical, sensible, balanced kind of bloke, who is steeped in bowling spin, is the right bloke for the job for me. I think it's a good appointment, and I'm delighted for him on a personal level as well.
A few weeks ago, I spoke to Jake Lintott, who is at Warwickshire, and he's good mates with Jack Leach, came through the Somerset Academy at similar times. Both of them were let go. Both of them got back into county cricket when they were slightly older. Leach, when he was in his early 20s, Lintott, he's 26 or so. Lintott made the point that he felt with spin more than any other discipline that some spinners will just develop quite a lot later than that. So you need a separate pathway for spinners who might leave the game professionally at least at 18, 19, who then develop in their early 20s and get back into it. He felt there weren't enough opportunities for players like that to come back into it. And, you know, look at who number one spinner is at the moment. Jack Leach is someone who came into the professional game reasonably late. Moeen Ali before him was predominantly a batsman, kind of learnt it. So I don't know. I kind of wonder that all sounds really good, but in practice, there are still gaps there. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, and before those guys that you mentioned as well, Graham Swann, I mean, would have probably presumably left that talent pathway, having had his chance with England and then played a lot of county cricket. Again, he would have been someone who doesn't necessarily fall into what we're talking about now.
Just one thing to add. English cricket is quite a joined-up world. It talks to itself a lot. Someone like Dawson carries immense respect, and he will be in discussions with county coaches as well, constantly, about players that are coming through, players that could be given a chance and so on. And he's the kind of bloke who doesn't throw it around too much. He'll be quietly respected within the game. And this statement I thought was quite significant, really, by the ECB. This was an official statement and a quote from Mo Bobat. Richard's specialist coaching experience with spin bowlers was a further attraction, and he will support Jeetan Patel in an area that is a real priority for us. That kind of message, if that can be disseminated a little bit more loudly than it has been up to now, then we could begin to see at least the starting point of a change of attitudes and a change of culture, which has been discussed ad nauseum. But again, it's the conversation of now, and it's a necessary one. So for the ECB to be making these appointments in the first place, but also to be ramming that point home in the context of what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, I think is in its way, I think that is quite significant. It will take a hell of a lot to persuade coaches and captains of county clubs and, in brackets, CEOs and groundsmen, etc. It will take a hell of a lot to say to them, look, dry this pitch up a little bit if you can, bring spinners through a little bit more than we have done before. It will take a lot, but we have to be having these conversations a little bit more loudly than we have done before. And the appointment of characters like this is a small step in the right direction, I think.
Moving on to the England women's side, they beat New Zealand 2-1 in the ODI series there and went 1-0 up overnight after the first T20I. Tammy Beaumont scored half centuries in all three ODIs, and Nat Skiver and Catherine Brunt were both in the wickets. I spoke to Beaumont before the T20I, and I think the most interesting thing that she said was that although she's not played a whole lot of cricket in New Zealand, she thinks there's more movement in the air there than anywhere else, which she reckons brings Skiver into the game more as a frontline banker for 10 overs. In the T20I, England bowled New Zealand out for 96, Brunt, Skiver, Eccleston and Glenn all taking twofers. England chased that down reasonably comfortably. Before we get to that Beaumont interview, a question from Billy Johnson. Could Sophie Eccleston go down as the greatest England women's bowler of all time and across both men's and women's cricket, England's leading spin bowler of all time? Joe?
Yeah, absolutely she could. I mean, I think she's got Catherine Brunt in her sights already. And yes, Eccleston's still only 21. It feels like she's been around forever. She never goes for any runs. She seems to be taking more wickets now than she has done previously. Her and Sarah Glenn have formed a really potent partnership, and that whoever they play, they just don't seem to get them away. And given that England don't have kind of weak links elsewhere in their attack, it's a really formidable five strong attack they've come up with. So, yeah, I think Eccleston, given her career trajectory already, I think she's well on course to certainly be the leading England female bowler of all time. In terms of comparing men and women, it's difficult because you would generally judge a spinner by how many test wickets they've taken, and she's not going to take many test wickets in her career unless there's a dramatic change in the way women's cricket is structured. But certainly as a white ball bowler, she's going to be right up there with Adil Rashid, Graham Swann, And she's just got so many years ahead of her as well.
I think England's attack is looking really good. We talked about it a little bit last week. Real strength and depth in the pace department. And then with Eccleston and Glenn, as you mentioned, that is a really, really strong attack. I guess like the one thing that, the one hole really is that they don't have as much batting depth, like the likes of Danny Wyatt, Lauren Winfield Hill, Fran Wilson haven't quite taken the step up in terms of consistency, at least, as some of the others have. And they are still quite reliant on three or four of their batters quite a lot of the time. Do you think that's broadly fair?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I'm most interested about from this T20I series is seeing how Sophia Dunkey goes. If she does get a bat, she sort of got a thanks for coming award in the first game, having been recalled. But just in that T20 World Cup campaign in 2018, not the last one, she just kind of looked like she kind of got what was required of that role, that she was in that finisher's role, and also that she just like wasn't at all awed by the occasion. There were sort of a couple of games where she came in with like England really up against it and just was able to kind of negotiate all that pressure. And she was in form last year in the both for the England A side and in the Rachel Hayhoe-Flint Trophy. So I think she is one that they should look at as being the person, because yeah, you're right that there's those players that get to kick on, and it's been so long since England have actually had a new player in the top. I think Lauren Winfield Hill is the last player they had debut who's gone on to like have any sort of career as a batsman in the top six. So that's one that's interesting for me. I guess Sivers' utility in New Zealand conditions is especially relevant because that's obviously where the World Cup's going to be played. So that could give England an option to get a bit more batting depth in. Equally, if someone does kick on, it allows England just that much more flexibility in their bowling attack to sort of play maybe someone like an Izzy Wong, even if she breaks into it. They can know that like they've got this, up to 10 overs, but equally it could be four or five overs of pure pace up their sleeves for if the game requires it. So that could potentially be a huge factor for it. But yeah, I'd fascinated to see how Dunkey goes.
The issue around batting depth is a fair one, but it has to be contextualised by the quiet revolution that's taking place this winter and rolling into next summer and thereafter. That, as we know, 41 new domestic female pros have been training all winter. There'll be people within that 41 whose names are not well known, not even well known to this panel, who come the summer will be very well known by the end of it. And of all the percolations of this year coming up, this to me is the most interesting of the lot, really. We will have a bunch of individuals who will have struggled to juggle cricket with the pressures of work and so on and so on. Well, they would have now had a full winter of intense training as professional cricketers. That is hugely significant for the game. And we will see quite quickly that talent pool stretch and spread, and then the conversations which tend to revolve around 14, 15 players will be multiplied quite quickly after this summer. And it will change the whole look of it. It will change the complexion of the female game forevermore.
Well, here is that interview with Beaumont. I got the email through about her topping the world rankings for the first time whilst we were recording, but annoyingly, I didn't see it until we finished the interview. We're delighted to be joined over Zoom by Tammy Beaumont, who's in New Zealand in between the ODI and T20I series. First of all, Tammy, welcome to the show. What's it been like touring New Zealand of all places? I know they brought in restrictions in the last few days, but you couldn't have been in a more normal part of the world recently.
Yeah, I think it's been pretty much the best place to tour at the moment during COVID. Obviously, until a couple of weeks ago, it was completely COVID-free. And yeah, experiencing a little bit of normal life outside the cricket has just been amazing. Obviously, having had the bubble in Derby and over the summer, you know, you've kind of got a taste of what a lot of other teams are having to do and what the England men are having to cope with in India at the moment. So yeah, very grateful to be in New Zealand and also very grateful to be playing some cricket.
Before the series started, did you manage to get out and about and kind of live life as a normal person for a little bit?
Yeah, we had about 10 days in Queenstown. So we did our 2-week quarantine in a hotel quite strict protocols and everything like that. But once we got the all clear, we headed to Queenstown, and yeah, we really enjoyed it. Really got out and about. A few of us did a hike or two. We even got a little helicopter trip. It was like we were on a little holiday for a little bit while we were obviously in and around the training and working hard in the gym and everything. But yeah, it was very nice to just have that kind of week transition from, you know, being locked down for probably the best part of a year to actually enjoying a bit of freedom and getting that sort of out of our system a little bit to then really knuckle down and play some good cricket.
I think a lot of people would have seen on social media the photos and videos of you training at Queenstown. It's a pretty remarkable venue with the mountains in the background and next to the airport as well.
Yeah, it was amazing. Queenstown's a beautiful city or town, I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I think Sophie Eccleston and Danny Wyatt absolutely love planes. So they were very distracted at training, and it was their favourite cricket ground ever. Probably up there for one of mine. I think it was a pretty special place to play. And, you know, I think it's only kind of a club ground down there. So it's an incredible facility, and it was amazing kind of to kick off there.
Going to the cricket, how enjoyable was it getting back playing for England after a 4 or 5 month gap between series, obviously with the BBL in the middle of that?
Yeah, it was really nice, and obviously probably suit ODI cricket a little bit more. So the fact we hadn't played that for sort of 14 months was really kind of comforting for me to get back to the one I enjoy the most, really. And yeah, it was just great to get back out there with the girls. And, you know, we've only got a year to our World Cup now, so it's kind of getting real and it's starting to, you know, get back into that and really sort of put our best foot forward in that format. And yeah, it was just great to kind of get back out there and play some cricket, because, you know, it's been a bit lean on the old cricket fixtures for the last year or so.
Yeah, so on that, what is it about ODI cricket that you, I guess, prefer? I think it's been over a year since you last played in ODI and you're straight back into the runs. Is it just the tempo of it you find easier to get back into?
Yeah, I think in ODI cricket, I find it more of a mental game than kind of anything else. And so for me, it's all about, yeah, batting long, and particularly as an opening batter, like, you know, you can have 50 overs to bat. So, you know, for me, it's, I like to challenge myself to be got out, and, you know, the bowlers have to get me out instead of me give my wicket away. Whereas I think in T20 cricket, you've got to go, like, the parameters kind of make you be more attacking and give more chances. Whereas I think for me as a personality, that kind of aspect that you could try and play a perfect innings and not give a chance, and still do kind of the right thing for the team by building an innings and batting as long as possible, I think really suits my kind of personality and the way I like to play.
You're in the runs in all three games. How do you feel about your game at the moment? I think your ODI career average is ticked over 45, which is always nice.
Yeah, and I mean, the first half of my career, I think I averaged about 15. So it's certainly gone up and up in the last few years, which is nice. I think, yeah, for me, it's always just about contributing towards the team wins, and to be there at the end of the innings in two games, I think, is kind of probably a first for me, really. And obviously, we didn't get the win in that last game, but actually, it was a very kind of special innings for me, knowing that, you know, just because it got a bit hard, I still stuck it out. And yeah, kind of practicing that kind of skill of just making sure that I kind of do the job for as long as possible was really pleasing for me.
And you mentioned it's not that long until the World Cup now. I think it's actually nearly exactly a year to the day that the World Cup gets underway in New Zealand. So beating New Zealand in New Zealand is a good way to start that year. You were part of the side that won in 2017. How do you feel this side compares to how that side was a year out of the tournament?
Yeah, it feels quite similar, really. I think, you know, back then there was probably a lot of us that were a little bit untested in international cricket. You know, the likes of myself, Lauren Winfield, like Nat Siver had kind of just come through as a senior player. And yeah, it's kind of a really interesting time now. We're, you know, 4 years on, well, 5 years on it will be, and kind of the senior players and the kind of cement around the team. But we've got the likes of sort of Sophie Eccleston, Sarah Glenn, Freya Davis, all of those that haven't actually played that much. So yeah, it kind of feels a similar time that we are a little bit kind of untested again in a way. Like we are a bit of a fresh group. There's some fresh faces that haven't done World Cup cricket, 50 over cricket before. So yeah, it feels kind of like there's a good journey to go on, and there's sort of still a lot of learning and improvement to go. But yeah, certainly a good feeling with this group, really.
And then finally, in terms of conditions in New Zealand, seam played a fairly big role in the series. Nat Skiver in particular was exceptional. Is it fair to say that that's genuinely the case in New Zealand? And if so, how exciting is it that there's like real competition for places in the bowling department at the moment?
Yeah, I think I did tour New Zealand back in 2012, but I can't particularly remember what the wickets were like. But I do think they're a little bit English, if not a little bit more bounce and maybe a little bit more pace at times. So, yeah, I think it's good that we've got such depth in our seam department. And yeah, the way Nat Siv has been bowling in the Big Bash the last couple of years has been brilliant. So, you know, she really seems to suit bowling in places like Australia and here in New Zealand. So, yeah, it's really great that she's kind of really stepping up as like a genuine all-rounder with, she's always been an amazing batter at four, but to really kind of take those really crucial overs and kind of probably bowl 10, up to 10 overs each game, I think it's going to be massive for us to have that kind of fourth seamer.
Well, that was Tammy Beaumont. Ben, there was a moment on Twitter after the third test that created quite a lot of noise. Do you want to explain what happened and what you made of it?
Yeah, I don't want to spend too long on it, not least because it's already been discussed ad nauseam almost, but so in England's second innings, the third innings of the game, I think we were about six wickets down at the time. Alex Hartley, who's a World Cup winner, is currently doing punditry for BT Sport on England Women's Series in New Zealand, tweeted, "Nice of the England boys to get this test match finished just before England women play tonight," followed by a series of clap emojis, and then said, "Catch the game on BT Sport." A while after the game, so at the time it kind of, you know, well, there wasn't too much fuss. A while after the game, Rory Burns quote tweeted it, saying, "Very disappointing actually, considering all the boys do to support the women's game." And that was deleted long after. He tweeted that quite late at night, India time. So I guess possibly he felt, he thought that tweet had come out after England had lost, which is what it seems to be discussed, when actually it came out when it was clear the game was going to finish in 2 days, but not before, but not when it was absolutely certain. Ben Duckett also said something, a couple other county cricketers as well, Sam Patel, I think Chris Rushworth might have said something. And then since then, Alex Hartley's original tweet has kind of been leapt on by a huge number of, I guess, mostly male cricket fans, sort of a range of sort of personal abuse of her, abuse of the women's game, saying, "Why would you ever want to watch it?" That sort of thing, etc. And she's since tweeted about the sort of not so nice messages she's received, saying, "Remember, there's always a human on the other side reading what you're saying." Maybe there's not too much we made of it. I mean, it's just this is just Twitter. It's, you know, maybe this is part of the course. But I think, for me, I think there's a consideration when you're in a position like Burns and Duckett, and there are these power imbalances between the men's and women's game, to think about what the impact's going to be of your tweet. And I think the manner of their responses, which was sort of like a quoted tweet, which put it out publicly to all their followers rather than a reply to Hartley, you know, direct message to Hartley, kind of left her at the mercy of lots of fans to pile on her, which is why it's had this impact afterwards. From my point of view, I know other people feel differently. I didn't see anything wrong with Hartley's tweet, considering, you know, this is kind of the brand that she's sort of building. It's, you know, it's she makes these kind of jokes on her podcast with Kate Cross. She is now a broadcaster in her own right. She was tweeting very supportingly of England throughout the test match, sort of jokingly suggested that Root might be better than Ashwin, that sort of thing. And it felt to me like a bit of gallows humour after a disappointing patch of play, rather than someone sort of sticking the boot in, especially when, you know, she didn't tag any players. She didn't tag England cricket or anything like that. So it felt like a joke to her audience, which was then taken as something more.
If you've not already, I'd very much recommend Ben's piece on it on wisdom.com. It's very good. It's been shared quite a lot. Just search wisdom.com, Hartley Burns, to find it. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment, well, actually, I suppose it's in an hour's time. Rishi Sunak will be announcing his budget. So we don't know all the fine detail yet. But what we do know is that included within it will be a $300 million summer sports recovery package, a significant chunk of which will be going towards cricket, which is obviously both welcome and necessary. We know the ECB announced last September that the game had lost 100 million due to the pandemic, and the final figure is likely to be double that. Like pretty much every industry, sport, recreation in this country, it's desperately in need of support. And that was emphasised a few days ago when Kent announced their financial results for 2020. So they received an extra 600,000 last year from the ECB, through the new TV deal with Sky, and then extra grants in place because of the pandemic. But despite that, Kent announced a deficit of £217,000 and a drop in income from all other areas of nearly £2 million. Other counties will inevitably be reporting similar losses in the next few weeks. So that hopefully a full schedule of cricket this summer and fans returning from May onwards and this additional support from the government can keep the counties ticking along. And I do think there'll be a lot of sports fans desperate to watch some live sport this summer, and it's a great chance for cricket to grab hold of some of those new supporters. But I found it interesting, we produce, among all the various other bits and bobs in cricket we do, we produce the Cricketers Who's Who book each year. So I spent the last week or so kind of proofing pages and trawling through squad lists. And it's encouraging to see that the kind of exodus of players from the county game that some of us feared hasn't really materialised as far as I can tell. Obviously, a few players have been let go, as they are every winter, but it doesn't seem like more than usual to me. Instead, I think what we're seeing is counties being much more circumspect in signing overseas players, and the closing of the Colpack loophole has provided a lot of counties with an opportunity to save some cash too. And prioritising kind of young homegrown talent is kind of surely the right and sustainable course of action at the moment, perhaps at any time, but certainly now. And counties seem to be following that. And I think that the PCA, the counties and the players themselves deserve a lot of credit for the fact that the situation isn't more dire than it is, because, and that more players haven't been released. Phil did a piece for Wisden Cricket Monthly a couple of months back, talking to Darryl Mitchell, who's the outgoing PCA chairman, and Rob Lynch, who's the chief exec there. And in that piece, it came up that around 3.8 million has been saved through voluntary salary reductions and relinquishing a percentage of prize money last summer. So if you think that money has obviously helped hugely, and I think there's a real sense that the game is clubbed together and they focused on the bigger picture and made sure that the people, clubs, players aren't left behind. And hopefully now we're going to start beginning to turn a corner. And whilst a huge amount of damage has been done, hopefully it's repairable.
Just to add to that, the big date in people's heads is June 21, isn't it? June 21 is when the government have penciled in, probably with a very light H pencil, the return of full-scale crowds to sporting events. The Blast, which is obviously the cash cow of counties, even now, folks, even now in Hundred Land, begins on June the 10th, so 11 days before that key date in the government's diary. I've heard that there will be a push to try and bring that forward with regards to cricket, and that there will be a big push for test events from April, if not by May, and that there will be a drive to try and get those early fixtures with as many fans in as possible. It may well be that it will be reduced numbers or 25%, which is what's being earmarked from May onwards. Or it may be that they can lobby the government and try and get a few more in. But can't emphasise it enough, every single day counts now for these counties. Every day that they don't get people in is one day nearer to real problems financially. All being well, we'll get crowds in by midsummer at the very latest, and we'll have the vast majority of one day cricket played this summer with crowds in. And obviously the one day cup follows, and the 100 follows after the T20 stuff gets going, before the T20 stuff returns at the end of the season to be rounded up. So the vast majority of pyjama cricket at the moment will be covered by fans. We just cross our fingers that those dates can be at least honoured, and that things don't go backwards in this ongoing saga, because the counties need it. It is really existential stuff now for some of them.
I think the fans need it too. It's been a long time since everyone's been in a stadium, in a full crowd, etc. My moment of the week is actually fan related. It was in the PSL. It was a really good match between Karachi and Lahore, who are two of the better sides in that competition. And there's a moment at the start of the second innings of the game where Amir had already taken one wicket in the opening over, and he was kind of geeing the crowd on, trying to get them to cheer louder and louder, running in with the crowd full volume. He clean bowls Joe Denley for a second wicket in that opening over, and the crowd went even more crazy. It was absolutely brilliant. Great game as well, by the way. Some interesting moments. There was a spectacular Denley-esque drop off Shaheen early in the first over of the game. Shaheen also got Babar Azam out, clean bowled with a lovely delivery, and then put his arm around Babar as Babar was walking off, which I'm not too sure what Babar would have thought about that. And Shaheen also gave Amir a bit of a send-off when he got him out at the end of that innings as well. So a very good game of cricket. And I'm really enjoying the PSL this year, more so than previous years. Lots of high scores, but also bowlers doing very a lot of young bowlers who I've not heard of before doing very well. So an exciting, as ever, quite unpredictable tournament.
Yeah, there was a game yesterday, and I think their team are doing pretty badly, but Dale Steyn was part of a bowling trio with Mohammad Hasnain and Nasim Shah, and you won't get many bowling trios where Dale Steyn is the slowest of the three, which I think he would be at the moment. And Paul Sterling, the Irishman, was just carving them all out of the ground. It's been, yeah, great entertainment.
Didn't Dale Steyn perhaps rather mischievously say that he prefers the PSL to the IPL?
He's rowed back on that a bit this morning. He said his quotes were taken out of context. But I thought what he said was quite interesting. And obviously, he might have been taken out of context, but there is probably some truth in it, that the kind of the whole spectacle around the IPL means it's about more than just the cricket. And that isn't the same in PSL, where it's largely about the cricket and everything else is just additional. I think that seems like a perfectly reasonable point to make, but albeit quite a brave one, given some of the passions involved in that particular debate.
The problem for staying there is it wasn't taken out of context, and we know this because it's a YouTube video. It wasn't just reported quotes, it's just an interview you can watch. And everything that was quoted, Steyn did say, I watched it yesterday. The reaction to what he said was completely mad.
Does he not? He doesn't have an IPL deal for this year, is that right? And some people are saying, like, oh, that's the reason he said it now. I think he's always been pretty public about, you know, not liking these media engagements and that sort of thing. I remember doing a World Cup media day for the 2019 World Cup, where, you know, you're doing all these sorts of challenges and stuff with the players. It's kind of like a bit of fun, but also I can imagine it's not what they hugely want to be doing, want to be getting their heads right for a global tournament. And he, out of all the players, I think, looked the most unhappy to be there. We know he's sort of like a laid-back guy in general, in terms of, you know, what he likes to do outside of cricket, the surfing, the, you know, extreme sports, that kind of thing. And I think
the acting, he's in a film, isn't he? He's in an Adam Sandler film.
He is in the Adam Sandler film Blended. Yeah, I'm glad we finally got to mention that on the podcast. He gets pumped back over his head by a 9-year-old, which I don't know if that's affected his IPL deal for this year. But yeah, I think that it's he's not doing it out of any sort of a frustration that he hasn't picked up this year. I think that, yeah, it's genuine how he feels. And I think it's fair enough.
There have been a couple more T20Is between Australia and New Zealand since we last recorded. Overnight, Australia won their first game of the series. Claire Maxwell hit 70 off 31 to help Australia to 206. Before Ashton Agar took 6 for 30 to see New Zealand fall well short. I think Agar is quite an odd one. I feel, Joe, we had that conversation a couple of weeks ago about English players not getting picked up in the IPL. I feel like if we were Australian, he'd be someone that we mentioned. His T20I record is really, really good. Average of just 19, economy of just over 7 from about 30 games. So obviously space for conventional finger spinners in T20 cricket. And I think that from the point of view of Australia's balance in T20 cricket, they would be so much better if Agar was a slightly better batsman. It's just him batting at 7 is just one position too high, I feel, and they kind of need him there to get all their bowling in.
For me though, sorry, I know Agar bowled well, yeah, but Maxwell's innings was the gem. He's not been hitting them too well recently. I think he said after the game that he was sort of struggling to hit them as a right-hander, so he'd have a go as a left-hander for a bit and just absolutely nailed 3 switch hits, and then was seeing it perfectly fine. Hit 28 runs off one Jimmy Neesham over, including smashing a stadium chair to bits. Just punched a hole right through it with a 6 into the stands. So yeah, that was a dig the highlights out of that if you fancy.
And Ben, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment of the week is a historic one, actually. It's the first time a non-England test match has been broadcast on free-to-air TV in the UK. This was only announced yesterday when Free Sports announced that they had got the deal to show all of Afghanistan and Zimbabwe's home matches for the next 3 years. And that started with an Afghanistan-Zimbabwe test match, which is on right now, but not for much longer. Afghanistan at 86 for 7, and that's in danger of finishing within 2 days, just like the last game. But it's been a good watch, though, even though it's going to be a short one. There's been some some good stuff on show. Afghanistan's Ibrahim Zadran, who's 19 years old, batted well in the second innings. Victor Naiuchi for Zimbabwe looks a handy bowler. But it's just great to have more free-to-air cricket in general. And there will be some really big names or big teams that you can watch in that. I think India, Pakistan, Australia all have games against those teams at home lined up. And also there'll be the possibility of an Ireland test match at some point on free-to-air TV in the UK, which is really great as well. Yeah, that's great. And some more good news, I guess.
Yeah, we should just talk about the test itself. It's good, looking pretty likely to finish within 2 days. Afghanistan scored 131 in the first innings. Zimbabwe scored 215 response, and Afghanistan are currently 88 for 7, still 31 behind Zimbabwe's total. There was one thing that came through just before we started recording that was too late to be my moment of the week, but I think it's worth mentioning anyway, that Notts have announced that Haseeb Hameed will be their vice captain in the Canton Championship in 2021, and their captain in the Royal London One Day Cup, which is excellent news and good for Hameed. That is it for today's show. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Phil. Thanks for listening, folks. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, tell your friends. And why not leave us a 5-star review on the podcast app to show your appreciation. We'll be back next week. Cheers.